This program is taking a break, so today's episode is a repeat.
Yeah, and there's huge opportunities. I mean, instead of thinking about water as an opportunity to make money, and instead of focusing on the unfairness of the water bottlers taking it for nothing, I mean, why don't we look at our water resource and say, what is the best use of our water? How can we create the communities that we want? How can we protect the environment by allocating water in the right way? So instead of going to a market model and saying, well, look, the users that can pay the most are the most economically efficient, they should get our water, and that will happen if we create a market for water, which is actually happening in Christchurch at the moment anyway, and we can talk about that in a minute. But instead of doing that, why don't we look at the way we're using water and say, well, why don't we make it easy for example, permaculture farms to access water, and make it really, really difficult for intensive dairy to access water? Why don't we look at it like that? So we're looking at outcomes rather than dollars. The water bottler's taking it for nothing.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. On the phone from Glen Orchy at the top of Lake Waikatipu in the South Island, I have Nikki Gladding. And Nikki is the co-convener of Aotearoa Water Action, AWA, and also is a councillor on the Queenstown Lakes District Council. She's concerned about the control and allocation of fresh water in New Zealand and is currently involved in two appeals challenging the consents granted to three water bottle companies. So, kia ora, thank you for coming and wanting to let us know, Nikki.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having us on your show.
Yes, well, water is another big topic. A couple of weeks ago, I had Murray Horton on who really owns New Zealand, and now we're having a look at a very important issue of our water, or the Māori word, why. And so, Nikki, should we here in New Zealand be bottling our water and sending it overseas?
Good question, Tim. For lots of reasons, obviously my position would be no, we shouldn't. And I think from the publicity that we've had on the water bottling issue over the last few years, I think it's an opinion that's shared by most New Zealanders across a whole range of political spectrums. I think there's a real concern that we don't have enough clean drinking water in New Zealand for New Zealanders, and obviously local councils are having trouble providing fresh water for their communities. And then of course there's the issue around plastic. A lot of people really concerned about plastic waste, and these plants produce billions of plastic bottles over the lifetime of their consent. So it's a huge issue for everybody across the country, I think.
Well, it comes to a shock for most people to realise that New Zealand, clean and green New Zealand, that councils are having difficulty sourcing good water. This is a shock to most people. How come?
There's a range of issues there. I mean, obviously small councils don't have a lot of money, and a lot of our boards for community supplies are sourced from quite shallow groundwater, and so to get the better stuff you have to go deeper, but obviously aquifers are not evenly spread throughout New Zealand. Some councils take surface water and they treat it, and obviously the condition of the surface water determines how much treatment needs to be done. We've got this issue now, particularly in Canterbury, but across New Zealand, with nitrates in shallow groundwater. Of course, that can't be treated. That's one thing to put chlorine in and deal with viral and bacterial sort of contaminants in your water supply, but it's quite another to try and deal with the issue of nitrates, and that's obviously from intensive farming over decades, and we've got nitrates still coming through the soil into our aquifers, and they will be coming for decades. So it's not a problem that we can get rid of quickly. So I'm really concerned that water bottlers are coming into New Zealand and taking our very best water, our cleanest water, our deepest water, and local communities are having to fork out a lot of money to treat their water and potentially not even be able to get healthy, clean, nitrate-free water. especially into the future, and we have to think ahead, obviously. I mean, we're granting consents for these bottling companies for 30 years because they're putting in massive infrastructure and they need that security, but what is our groundwater going to look like in 30 years' time, and what are our community supplies going to look like? So we have to be thinking about future generations all the time when we're making these decisions, and I don't think that's happening at the moment.
Who is giving the decisions? Who are allowing these decisions, Nikki?
It's a really interesting situation, the way these companies sort of come to be. I mean, existing in New Zealand at the moment, we have quite a number of small water bottling plants, and they don't produce a lot. But what we're seeing now is some bigger companies, so larger consents, and they require overseas investment because the plant's $50 million to build your plant. It's millions of dollars to get your consent through. So we've now got sort of overseas investors coming in. And so it starts at the highest level. We've got these companies talking to ministers directly. We've got New Zealand Trade and Enterprise supporting New Zealanders who want to sell land to overseas investors who want to bottle water. So they're effectively selling our water, and they've acknowledged that in email. So we've got it at the highest level there, and NZTE does support water bottling companies. There's about eight it's supported over the years, and I think there's six at the moment that it's supporting through its Focus 700 program. So New Zealand taxpayers are actually supporting water bottling companies. So it happens at that level. Some of the overseas companies that come in need Overseas Investment Office consent. So that office is making decisions under that legislation, under the Overseas Investment Act. And we have solicitors making decisions on behalf of New Zealand about what our water should be used for. And then you get down to the level where the community sort of gets involved, which is at the resource consent level, so under the Resource Management Act. So there are decisions being made at every level, and I'm quite concerned about those decisions at the high level and how much impact they have on the decisions at the lower level. For example, if we encourage a company to come here, as we did with Nongsu Spring, which is the New Zealand company is Cresswell, and we're in court with them at the moment in Otakiri. That's been on the news a bit, so readers might have heard of it, or listeners might have heard about it. But they came here, and NZT actually brought the chairman out, showed them around the country. They had officers from NZTE helping them to find the water that they wanted. When it happens at that high level and these companies invest a lot of money in coming here and trying to set up, is it difficult then, potentially under our free trade agreements or potentially just politically, to turn them down at the resource consenting level? So there's a lot of, I think, research needs to be done, and we need to have a really good review of how this whole system of water allocation for bottling is working.
Yes, could you clarify again, New Zealand TE?
NZTE is New Zealand Trade and Enterprise, so that's an agency run under MB, Ministry of Innovation, Business and Employment, is that right? And so their mantra is basically to grow New Zealand businesses bigger, better, faster. But it's not just New Zealand businesses, it can be New Zealand businesses that are ultimately owned by a foreign company, as is the case with Cresswell New Zealand, which is the bottling company that's wanting to run out of Otakiri. And same thing with Cloud Ocean Water, which is the New Zealand company in Christchurch, which we've taken to court, but ultimately that's foreign owned as well. So NZTE has given up actively promoting water bottling to foreign investors. So they are no longer going out there and saying, come and invest in New Zealand's water. But they will still help a New Zealand landowner with a large water consent, water permit, to sell their land to a foreign investor.
Right. You mentioned these companies being foreign owned. Can you give us an understanding of what countries have ownership or are taking water out of New Zealand to that particular country, please?
Yeah, there's a number involved. I've just had a look recently, and you know, there's everything from Australian companies that are ultimately owned in Japan, Fruitcore Suntory. We've got New Zealand companies, obviously, bottling directly, but these big ones that have come on, the ones that we're now battling in court, are ultimately owned in China.
And I noticed that Coca-Cola owns a lot of water in New Zealand too, is that correct, through their plastic bottles?
I believe they've got a plant in Auckland and also one in Christchurch. Yeah, so they do.
Do you think that New Zealand public have a right to know who is buying and sending our water offshore?
Yeah, I think they do, although I think it's not the biggest issue. I think regardless of who's taking it and where it's going, we still have these issues with should they be taking it, what are the impacts on our aquifers, what are the impacts on future community supplies, what about the plastic? It really doesn't matter who's bottling it and where it's going, except perhaps if you're thinking about emissions, carbon emissions, and the cost of in that, or perhaps what are the recycling facilities in those countries. That makes a difference, and I guess ultimately the profit and where that's going. But at the end of the day, we could make a whole lot of money out of this, but we're still going to have the issues that arise from the water bottling. So to me, the money isn't the biggest issue here.
Okay. What I just wish to know, Nikki, are you able to tell us how much drinking water actually leaves New Zealand annually?
It's a tricky one. I don't think the figures that we have are excellent because a lot of these supplies aren't metered or the councils don't keep on top of them, and so it's rough estimates that we've got. But in 2017, there was a report that Deloitte did for the Ministry for the Environment, and they had 28 million litres that were being exported every year, and domestic use was about 158 million litres of bottled water. So that was 2017. 2018, the figures I got was 31.5 million litres exported. Last year, 118 million litres exported, and that was from TVNZ, I think, did a piece on that. So that's about a 270% increase. And that's just indicative of the size of these new plants that are coming on board. So I suspect a lot of that was due to Cloud Ocean Water in Christchurch coming on board with their massive scale. And we're going to see big leaps into the future as more of these big plants come on board, unless we stop them.
Yeah, I remember way back, maybe about 30-odd years ago, there's a crowd called Triune, and they were looking at coming into the Milford Sound with a big tanker and taking the water directly into that tanker. And I don't know what happened to that idea, but I'm sort of glad it hasn't happened. But we also had one down in Ashburton that really got New Zealanders' interest. Could you give us a quick appraisal of what happened there, please, Nikki?
Yeah, sure. So I got involved in the water bottling thing sort of at the end of that. But that was headed up by a woman called Jean Branya. She started a movement called Bung the Boar. And I believe it was around the Ashburton District Council was planning on selling what they called Lot 9. So it was a piece of land that had a large water permit attached to it. And the company wanted to bottle the water. And so the community got up in arms and actually managed to sort of put forward a really successful campaign. And ultimately, the council didn't sell the land and all the water permits. Obviously, the bottling didn't go ahead. But it was a really, really good example of the community just persistent, you know, in the face of impossible odds. And ultimately there were massive petitions. There was one presented to Minister Parker, I think it had 15,000 signatures calling for a moratorium on water bottling. So they got a lot of publicity. And government took notice. I've actually had their name pop up in some of the information that I've had back from the Ministry for the Environment. So, yeah, really successful campaign. Great thing.
So there'd be a number of councils over New Zealand, sort of in strategic areas where water is. Have they been made aware of the fact that they're going to be on notice if they allow overseas interests to come in and take water? And is there also, do they have to put a notice in the newspapers saying that there is an expression of interest by overseas water companies in New Zealand, particular in areas that the councils have jurisdiction over?
That would be nice if they had to do that, but they don't. So there are some places, generally it's where the aquifers are, so where our good water is, and also where those aquifers are close to ports. That seems to be where the water bottlers are concentrating their activity. So in the Bay of Plenty, near Whakatane, there's a good aquifer and they're close to the port of Tauranga. There's actually three water bottling plants within a 2 kilometre radius. So, and that council, interestingly enough, Whakatane District Council, was actively promoting the bottling industry, and they even did a piece, ratepayer funded, on the value proposition of water bottling. So they have been instrumental in trying to get this company, Cresswell New Zealand, to bottle in Whakatane, which is really interesting. And they have heard the consent up there, so they were involved in making the notification decision and Yeah, so I guess at the end of the day, what councils do is they process resource consents, and there's a clear process that they have to follow under the Resource Management Act. With water bottling, it's whether or not they judge the effects to be minor or more than minor or significant. There is a public interest, significant public interest in water bottling, and they could justify public notification of these consents, but it doesn't seem to be happening. We've had consents in Canterbury and Christchurch made by commissioners to, you know, increase the depth of the bore for the water bottlers, made non-notified despite the fact that the Christchurch City Council was concerned about its own bore and its own water take into the future. So I think different councils have a different view of it. Some actually want it. They see it as jobs for their local community and they're pleased to have the water bottlers. Others are really concerned about their drinking water supplies. So it varies across the country. But there is no obligation on the councils to publicly notify or let the community know what applications are coming to it, unfortunately.
Oh, well, this could be an election issue. Yet another one. Can you tell me the name again of the Whakatane crowd who wanted to, the name of the company in Whakatane again?
Water company, yeah, it's Cresswell New Zealand Limited.
Okay. Now, is this not a sovereignty issue? And what about Māori? Do they not get upset at seeing this happen?
Yeah, iwi have done a great job, actually. There are actually some iwi that are involved in bottling, and there was a proposal recently to bottle in Murupara, and that's recently fallen over because the iwi realised that they weren't going to have control of the water consent. So that was interesting. But yeah, it is a sovereignty issue. It's an interesting one. I mean, how much control do we have of our water once we grant these consents to these companies and they invest $50 million in a plant? What is our ability to actually say you can't take that water anymore? So if you're looking at our free trade agreements or just, I guess, the politics around trade and our economy, what in reality can we do if we decide we need the water and they have it and we can't get it back? So if we're looking at, as you pointed out before, issues around Māori rights to fresh water, at the moment, a lot of our water is allocated, a lot of areas are over-allocated, and we still haven't grappled with Māori rights to fresh water. Presumably, if we do, we get to the point where we may have to take some water back in order to meet their needs, you know, the needs for their land. And how do we do that? And there's also the issue of cultural values. Can we stop these companies from coming in and taking our water and getting these consents when the bottling of the water and the sending it overseas is deeply offending so many iwi? So there's questions under Overseas Investment Act. We can't, under our free trade agreements, we can't make new classes of sensitive assets under the Overseas Investment Act. So at the moment, land is a sensitive asset, and certain classes of land, so farmland over 5 hectares or industrial land or any business, I guess, that you have to pay more than $100 million for, that the foreign company then has to go to the Overseas Investment Office and apply for consent. We don't have that with water. So the government has kindly added some provisions around consideration of water bottling, but they only apply when the land's sensitive. And so we're not actually able to adequately control water because we can't make it a class of sensitive asset in its own right. So it's very difficult to control overseas control of water, because if a company wants to come in and buy a piece of land and there's a water permit on it, that water permit automatically transfers to that company. And then what rights do we have to remove that under our trade agreement? So it's a really difficult one. And these are all issues that we're going to have to start grappling with now.
Very much so. I mean, these trade agreements, they're usually rammed through, but doesn't actually, we need to go back to the community on all these issues, and there should be, should we say, a provision in situations where an overseas company buys land in New Zealand and it has a water right. We need to have a provision stating if it's an overseas country, we have to then renegotiate around that water right. It has to be locked down in law, really.
But they've not done that. What they've done is actually, and I don't know really what this means, and you need a legal brain on it, but in the Annex 2 of our CPTPP agreement, There's actually a provision or a reservation that says New Zealand reserves the right to adopt or maintain any measure with respect to the water, including the allocation, collection, treatment and distribution of drinking water. But it then goes on to say this reservation does not apply to the wholesale trade and retail of bottled mineral aerated and natural water. So I'm not sure how much control we have over our water and how where that reservation applies. Does it just that caveat apply to the whole reservation, or does it just, I don't know, but it seems this has been thought through clearly when that agreement was pulled together.
Boy, water is just one commodity, but there is so much involved in it, really. It's profound that we have not yet really got a government who's put their head around it and gone back to the community and, you know, asked for submissions, yet writing submissions. I've written so many submissions in my life, I'm tired of it as well. And yet we need to really grapple with this one because of the, you know, the four major elements, earth, water, air and fire. Here we have water, which takes up sort of 75% of our body. We must make sure that we have the best in this country, particularly for our children and future generations.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so many things that we don't understand about it. We don't understand what's going on with our aquifers. We don't understand the impacts of climate change and how much water we're going to need. There's so many unknowns if we don't get on top of this soon. And at the end of the day, it does. It boils down to actually just having the guts to grapple with this issue of Māori rights to fresh water. Until we do that, we're not going to move anywhere. And there's huge opportunities. I mean, instead of thinking about water as an opportunity to make money, and instead of focusing on the unfairness of the water bottlers taking it for nothing, I mean, why don't we look at our water resource and say, what is the best use of our water? How can we create the communities that we want? How can we protect the environment by allocating water in the right way? So instead of going to a market model and saying, well, look, that the users that can pay the most are the most economically efficient, they should get our water, and that will happen if we create a market for water, which is actually happening in Christchurch at the moment anyway, and we can talk about that in a minute. But instead of doing that, why don't we look at the way we're using water and say, well, why don't we make it easy for example, permaculture farms to access water, and make it really, really difficult for intensive dairy to access water? Why don't we look at it like that? So we're looking at outcomes rather than dollars.
Yeah, well, we definitely do. Now, you just said overseas companies are taking our water for nothing. And could you clarify that? Now, we've bought this land, and once they've got the land, they can actually suck it dry or put an... Is this what you're saying?
Yeah, so then, I mean, there's no ability for them to charge on volume.
Why?
Well, one, it's not a council reticulated at the moment. New Zealanders will know across the country that they have to pay, you know, a set targeted rate for their water supply that goes towards the infrastructure, and some communities have to pay per litre. But this isn't a council supply, this is a bore. So this is their private bore, and water is a commons, and we can't charge for water. We can only charge for the use of the infrastructure via council reticulated networks. So what they do is, I mean, it isn't cheap to set up a water bottling company. Obviously, you've got to come in, you've got to buy the land, you've got to negotiate the consents, you've got to build the plant, $50 million worth. It's an expensive exercise, and then you've got to look at your supply chains and so on and so forth. But your consent, your actual getting your consent, once you've got it, you might pay a yearly maintenance fee on that consent, a few thousand dollars. You might pay that once up front, depending on the council. And then after that, you're good to go. So the water itself is free, and then you're basically manufacturing plastic bottles to put the water in, and off it goes.
Okay, now you just mentioned the commons. This is going to shock a few people that this water's just been pumped out. It's been pumped out at no cost, because there's the other side of it. 5G, they're putting 5G towers all around, and they're putting wireless technologies right across the country. Our air, our atmosphere is also the commons, is it not?
I guess it is. I haven't really looked into the depths of the 5G issue. I'm a bit concerned about that one, and that the way that the legislation has been structured so that they don't actually have to consult with local communities that concerns me. And I think more research needs to be done, but obviously a very different issue to the water bottling. But again, I suppose it comes down to a lack of say on the part of the communities of their, what are their resources. It is a commons and it is for all of us, and yet the communities and the people that are affected often don't get a say.
Very good. Yeah, now this is a really important statement that you're making, that the water underneath these places, they can just keep on taking. I honestly thought that there was a situation there, particularly in the Canterbury Plains there, only a certain amount of water is allowed to be used for irrigation, where once, of course, it was just arable farms, but when cow farming came in or dairy farming came in, they needed to drag out as much water as possible because it was a very water-intensive industry, particularly to get grass growing all through summer, and so they irrigated to make sure that there was lush grass, and that there was a particular allocation that said you can't go over so much. Is that not true?
Yes, what the groundwater scientists do that work for the council, they set an allocation limit across the catchment, and you can't take any more than that. So regardless of all these people saying, oh, all this water's flowing out to sea, they actually have to maintain a certain amount in the aquifer, and you can only take a certain amount, and that depends on the refill, and it can change over time. Canterbury's fully allocated. So what's happening in Canterbury now is if you want more water, you need to buy it. There's a company that's set up called Hydro Trader, and farmers can take water that they've have a permit for, and they can effectively sell that permit to somebody else for the same purposes. It gets a little bit different when you want to take an irrigation consent and turn it into a water bottling consent. But the way Environment Canterbury, which is the regional council down there, is treating these permits, basically if you have a permit for irrigation, it's not difficult to transfer it to water bottling because water bottling is efficient. There's limited wastage, and the effects on the aquifer are considered to be no different to the irrigation permit, essentially, although one is what we call fully consumptive, the water for water bottling, and it goes in the bottles, and the whole lot gets taken offshore, whereas with irrigation it goes back to land and some will filter back through. But yeah, that's my concern, is a number of irrigation consents have been varied to allow for bottling, and they're not bottling, they're not using the water for bottling. It's almost as though they're using the bottling consent to prop up the value of the land, because it's recognised that water bottling is of value. So this has happened quite explicitly in a number of applications. Sanford was the most recent one. They've got a mussel farm in Rickerton, sorry, not a mussel farm, a mussel processing plant in Rickerton. And their application to the regional council actually said, we want to add water bottling. We're selling our plant. We've got this factory that could be used for a number of things, and we want to add water bottling. We don't intend to water bottle ourselves, but we're selling the plant, and essentially they're wanting to boost the value of their property by adding this water bottling consent. So across the country this has happened, and we've now got 34 billion litres per year, at least, that was based on 2017 figures, consented for bottling. So what we're exporting at the moment is around 118 million litres per year. 34 billion litres are consented for bottling.
Who would have allowed that? I mean, we've got to actually have some names of the people in the departments, because, boy, it seems so, I don't know, shifty.
Well, it's not. That's the thing. It's not shifty because the water bottling industry isn't regulated. So all these planners who are protesting these consents can do is look at the effects, because the Resource Management Act is an effects-based scheme, and there are no specific rules around water bottling. They're not in the RMA, they're not in our national policy statement for fresh water management, and most of our, because it's a new industry, especially large-scale bottling, there are no rules in any of our plans, our regional plans or our district plans, around water bottling, despite the fact that the industry has some really specific effects. For example, the number of trucks. So out of Cresswell, one of the biggest issues is that it's going to produce 202 truck movements daily, and they're not small trucks. So these trucks with two containers, so 220-foot containers or 140-foot container coming out of that plant. And they truck through all these tiny wee towns on the way to Tauranga, to the port. So because it's a new industry, it just hasn't been dealt with. And so these planners are processing these applications, which really, yes, they could turn them down, but it's also difficult because those companies can come back and challenge and appeal those decisions, and then that costs the local councils, which ultimately costs the ratepayers. So when we're fighting these applications, we're paying twice. We're paying in rates for the council's legal bills, and we're also paying for our own bottling, our own appeal. So, I mean, the whole thing is really unfair on local communities, and we really need to look at this. So what I've done is the council that I'm on, Queenstown Lakes District Council, has put forward a remit to Local Government New Zealand, and that's basically an opportunity for all the councils to come together and agree that we want Local Government New Zealand to advocate for a moratorium on water bottling applications, on new ones, and a review of all of these banked water bottling consents that are sitting there with this 34 billion litres of water that could be bottled, to take a look at that and withdraw that right from those permits potentially, and to look at the legislation, see if it's adequate to manage the effects of the industry, and see what legislation we might need to put in place to manage it effectively. So that will be voted on at the end of August at Local Government New Zealand's AGM.
I'm speaking with Nikki Gladding of AWA Aotearoa Water Action.org.nz. Aotearoa Water Action.org.nz. Check their video out. We need a Royal Commission, and we need a Royal Commission, but we don't necessarily have to have all these top academics there. We need some people from the community, from some of the councils who have got a greater connection with the people on the land, because usually a Royal Commission, sometimes it just gets too top heavy. We need some doctors. We need some people who have been maybe in the health industry.
We need to look at holistically, because it's in terms of the legislation and the way these things get processed through government, right from NZGA and the other right the way down, but we also need to look at the effects holistically and into the future as well. So you're right, we need a lot of voices around that table so that we can get the full picture, because otherwise water bottling just looks like a use of water that is not wasteful, that doesn't pollute our rivers directly. We can ship it off overseas and make a whole lot of money, but in reality that's not the case. And I would hate to see our farmland now dotted with industrial water bottling plants. It just, yeah, it would be horrendous. And the environmental impacts are massive. I mean, what we're doing with that industry is exporting the environmental costs. Or we think we are, because ultimately plastic's going to come back to bite us wherever we send it.
Yeah, very much so. Because with this plastic, there's a thing called PET, P-E-T. Can you give us a little understanding of that? Because essentially, if you have a bottle of water and you drink it, and in the first day, it's fine, but you can't really reuse that bottle. And if it gets into the sunlight and God knows what else, and there's half water inside, yeah, then it tastes terrible. And we don't know, there's so many children at the moment are given bottles of drink, and they drink it, and they might not realize that it doesn't taste so well. There's a huge problem health-wise and environmental-wise around PET and plastic. Can you give us a little understanding, please, Nikki?
Yeah, I'm no expert on the plastics industry, to be honest, but I do know that, having looked at the industry, that they have found in some bottled water lots of microplastics floating around in that water that you're just about to drink. And obviously people understand, and you've just mentioned it, that if you leave these bottles in the sun or if they get cold, the plastic starts to degrade and you end up with it in your water. So it's, to me, it's not the healthiest option, and we need to be doing something about it. The plastics is interesting in that, you know, we can actually bottle into recycled plastic. Obviously there's still the energy factor and the emissions factor, but a lot of these places that we're sending water to won't use recycled plastic bottles. So I believe the company Cresswell that's bottling up at Autocarrier, wanting to, they're going to be using PET plastic. And I don't know, you know, when you buy the bottles, I'm not sure how you can be sure that the company hasn't left them out in the sun, or that the heat of leaving things in a container hasn't over time degraded that plastic. It's a real unknown. I think we're taking a bit of a risk with it. To me, tap's always better.
Could you repeat that last words again?
Tap water.
Yeah, that's then we get into the challenge of Chlorine and fluoride. I mean, gee, that's a huge backlash against fluoride too. And I've done some interviews around that with three really top professionals who have been in the industry for a long time, and they really come out saying that fluoride affects your intelligence factor, and there's a lot of information now out in China where they've actually proved it. And so when you have a look of water and what the whole process is, and you know, we need it.
And yeah, that's very hard to get, isn't it? Without chlorine, without fluoride, or without microplastics, how do you get pure water?
Well, it was interesting that 2 years ago I was in Bavaria, I was in Munich with a person who's been a water engineer. He sung me the virtues of clean, green New Zealand. Wow, aren't you lucky? And I said, yes, but well, we have fluoridated water and we have chlorinated water. And he just stopped in his tracks. He couldn't believe it. Because in Munich, they don't have that. They don't have that. And yet we in New Zealand, we've been conditioned, we've been programmed, we've been told. And because we're such an obedient country, we're actually just taking this on without really looking at it. And I mean, I used to be once a tap water drinker, you know, 50 years ago, but 45 years ago, I sort of woke up. And I'm now realizing that I went into filtration and I looked at all sorts of ways of being able to get out fluoride and chlorine and God knows what else, and then re-energize it with Johan Grander technology and Victor Schauberger technology to put more, to entrain more frequency and make the water more vital. And so it's imperative if our health is the only thing that we really require. And there's so many babies being born into the world where mums who are under stress and lots of work are having to take shortcuts, and tap water as well as a problem, or having bottled water. I've seen people with two dozen little bottles of water in their kitchen, and I think, oh my golly. So there's that one.
It's a conundrum, all right, because obviously, I mean, in Germany, when you've got denser populations and you can treat the water to a higher standard using UV or ozonation or whatever it is, I don't know. It's one of those things that's really difficult to solve. I had a chat recently to somebody who was immune compromised, and it goes both ways, but she was very concerned about her water being clean and needing to be chlorinated because her body could not take anything. You know, if any bug or bacteria or whatever came her way, she would be in trouble. And yet, at the same time, there's other people with chronic eczema, also immune conditions, who struggle with the concentration of chlorine in the water. So it's a really, really difficult one. It'd be nice to think we could treat it at source, and our reticulated networks would be that good, that there wouldn't be this concern about bugs then getting in between the source and the tap. And that's what Water New Zealand has been pushing. That's where the government concerns are around, that our networks are old and you can have infiltration into your network, particularly where you've got wastewater pipes running alongside your water supply, and then you get bacteria. And then most people will be fine with it, but it's those very vulnerable people that I think we're catering for there. Although if you look at Havelock North, there were an awful lot of people who got sick. So it's just one of those conundrums. It would be nice to think, and I'm trying to do it here in Glenorchy, is that we should get just a tap that isn't part of the reticulating network, that was had filtration or ozonation or whatever to get rid of any bacteria, where people could come and just fill up their reusable containers with non-chlorinated, non-fluoridated, safe to drink drinking water. And I think they've got a few of those sort of taps around Christchurch. I know in Dunedin, the States factory's got one, where they take water from a deep spring and people can just come and fill up their bottle.
Yes.
It's hard to know what the answer is. It really is.
I agree.
But it does seem ridiculous to be putting all of these, I mean, tons of chlorine, presumably, into water systems so that it's safe to drink, and then people don't want to drink it, so they buy a bottle of water, and we're using all this chlorinated water just for showering, washing, and then all of that is going out into our environment, and we don't really understand the effects of that. So it's a tricky one.
It's very tricky. At the top of the Kaimai Ranges between Tauranga and Matamata, Joe Swap Limited up there, he's got a pipe sticking out of the side of a bank, and people, and me included, Yep. Whenever going up and down there, we always stop and we bring our containers, usually the large plastic containers, the food grade containers, and they're okay for so many years, but we don't know how long they're actually, they have their, shall we say, their sovereignty before they start to allow certain particles to break away. But everybody used to stop there, and they still do, getting that water because they know that there's no chlorine and there's no fluoride. But then again, there could be cows above that, and there could be fertilizers getting into that water too. So it's hugely problematic, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And it's something I guess the government's trying to address it now, and I'm just hoping that where we're going with it isn't towards privatisation. So that's what we need to be really wary of. Going down the check, yes, but we're going to have better regulation, and we're going to be putting all this money into our water supplies and our wastewater networks and stormwater treatment and fabulous, but we need to make sure that it's always public owned, that it can never ever be privatised, that we can't ever sell shares in it, because then we're going to go the same way as electricity, and we can't do that with our water.
Thank you. This is a real important one. This is an election issue too in many ways. So can I mention there that, okay, we've got this water, this magnificent two gases, hydrogen and oxygen. A lot of people don't actually recognise or realise that the whole Pacific Ocean or all the oceans of the world are composed of just two invisible gases, H2O, two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. And they come together as profound. And then they form a liquid, a solid, that has to fall down. I mean, this is profound. It's a magical. It's a magical process that gas can actually end up becoming water. And we have a situation now where we've got this magnificent clear atoms that we take into our system, but we have to have containers. And the containers to hold it is a gigantic problem because we've got this recycling that's not happening too. And just over the last few months, I've sprung a waste container truck that was supposed to have two sections in the container, one for waste and landfill and the other for plastic and glass. And they were putting everything into the one truck and then quietly taking it away and dumping it, and without letting us know that there is a problem. So we have got major issues, and this is 2020, and where are the politicians who have got any, I don't know, ethics, principle, morality, honesty, a spine? Where are they?
Oh, I don't know. From being in the system for a very, very short time as a councillor, it is very difficult to move things quickly, but I'm pretty confident that there are things happening behind the scenes now. There's big reviews going on. I think there's a lot of money being thrown around. I think there's this recognition that we have a decade left to make a difference and to try and make this place livable for future generations. And I think more and more politicians are understanding that, because obviously the community's understanding that, and pressure's coming on, and the communities have done a great job there. So we just have to, all you can do is do your best. Everybody, each individual has to just go, what can I do to make a difference here and not give up. You know, the danger is apathy. And we just have to make sure that we're pushing our politicians hard. They're never going to do anything. Well, I shouldn't say that, but it's much easier to do it if the community is right behind you. So if you know you've got a clear consensus across the board, your community wants to spend money, your taxes, your rates, if people are happy to have them spend on that stuff rather than a nice big building, a fancy library with, if we want to look after our water and we want to recycle and focus on emissions, then that's where the money will go. So, yeah, what can I say? But write to your MPs, talk to your local politicians, comment on Facebook, fund community actions, click on petitions if I haven't said that already. Everything that you possibly can within your world that fits into your day, do it, because it does make a difference.
Yeah, I thank you. Yes, I know. It's a case of we have to become far more aware than what we, or how we are at the moment. And of course, the pressure's on since COVID thing has put another layer of challenge in our daily life, and many families now are under just far more pressure. And, you know, I want to thank you for encouraging people to be involved. It is, as I said before, writing submissions. Oh, boy. Carry on, please.
Yeah, no, it's exhausting, I know, and you feel like you're just banging your head against the brick wall sometimes, but you just keep at it. You do eventually get there. You do get the wins. Things do change, but it moves slowly, and if you want instant results, you know, you're in trouble because things don't happen instantly, but if you persist, you just keep at it, and you get tired, you take a break, and you come back to it. Don't give up. Keep talking to people, just because we are shifting this thing. There is change afoot. I truly believe that. It's just whether we can make it happen fast enough. And at the end of the day, it's your money. It's the ratepayers' money, taxpayers' money. Tell your politicians where you want it spent any way you can. And vote. It's election year. Make sure you vote.
Yes, most important thing, definitely. Now, you've got a website, aotearoawateraction.org.nz. Could you tell us a little bit about this, please?
Oh, about the website. The website is a work in progress, I would say. We've got a fabulous guy who set it up for us, but he's incredibly busy. And so what we try to do is keep all the articles, submissions, even court documents, what we can on that site for people to look at. We send out, and I'm not sure if it's via that or not, but we send out a newsletter. It's irregular, but when we have news, we send it out. We've got an email list. I'm not sure how attached to the website that is at the moment, but yeah, we're a really small team of people. What is literally 6, 7, 8 of us kind of working on these court actions and the website and social media stuff. So it's we're just average people. If I'm talking to the community, there's going to be a lot of other people out there that can do exactly what we've done, and it really does make a difference. So, but yeah, go have a look, go visit the website. It is, I think it's Aotearoa Water Action, www.aotearoawateraction.org, is it?
.org.nz.
Yeah, go and have a look at it. I think you can sign up there to receive the newsletters, and the more people we get involved, the better. We've also got a Facebook page as well, Aotearoa Water Action AWA, AWA. And it's a great website. We've got a lot of fully engaged people and lots of comments, and we'll put anything relevant on that. So you feel free to go and like that and follow us that way.
Yeah, this is all excellent. Thank you. Now, you've just been having a court case. You're having to actually fund us through the internet. Could you tell us a little bit more, please?
Yeah, so this is the case in Christchurch against Cloud Ocean Water, Rapaki Natural Resources Limited and Environment Canterbury, which was the regional council that granted the consent. So that's been going a long time now. We've been at it for about 3 years. I think the court appeal has been going for 2. We just lost in the High Court, but we are appealing. So we're just about to file a notice of appeal with the Court of Appeal. And yeah, what can I tell you about that one, Tom?
You can tell us, how did you get the money to be able to fight a corporation who has got loads of money? They can go to the bank and they can ring them up and a few clicks on the computer, and all of a sudden they've got another 4 or 5 zeros on what money they're wanting.
Yeah, they do seem to have a bottomless war chest, some of these companies. But it's tricky. What we did, we went out to the community. So we set up a Pledge Me page, and we just went for it. We hadn't done anything like that before, and the community was amazing. And I guess because it's an issue that everybody's concerned about, particularly Canterbury or Christchurch, they were really up in arms about their water. They like their clean water. And I think we raised through that one about $40,000 to get things moving. And then as time went on, the Christchurch City Council, when they weren't notified of the deepening of the water bottler's bore, in close proximity to their own bore, they decided to help us out, so they funded us to the tune of $50,000. And I guess that's what we do. Same thing up in on the Crestwell case. I'm a member of Sustainable AutoKitty, which is the group that's taken Crestwell New Zealand to court up there, again over water bottling. We've been out, I think we've run two Pledge Me campaigns for that one. Community comes to the party every time, so we've always made target And unfortunately, when it's something like the Environment Court, we've had to sort of shrink our appeal. So, you know, when we would have liked to challenge the regional consent and the district consent on a number of issues and have experts in to support our position, we just couldn't do that because of the cost. So where they had, might have had 6 or 7 expert witnesses, all potentially costing, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, I don't know, each. We couldn't do that. So we just had our planner and our lawyer. And that really limits the scope of your appeal and what you can do and the evidence that the court has from you to support your position. So it makes it really difficult. You've got to be really strategic. There is a fund under the Ministry for the Environment. It's called the Environmental Legal Assistance Fund, and it's for all community cases across New Zealand every year, and there's $600,000, that's it, that they have to divvy up amongst all of these groups, and that includes Forest and Bird and the Environmental Defence Society and Fish and Game. They will all apply for that fund, as well as smaller groups. So we applied to that. I think we made 3 applications, and we got turned down every single time. Whoa. But thank you to the community for supporting us. We couldn't have done it without you.
Yes, that's right. It's just people up the road, mums and dads, and
exactly. Young
people who have got a $5, $10, $20, and they throw it in. This is where the community has to come together. Can you get costs back? When you win, can you get all your costs back? And maybe, can you get a whack out of them?
You've got to win first, unfortunately. Yeah, so we'll just run the case to the end and see how we go. Unfortunately, costs can be awarded against us as well, so we have to be careful. But and along the way, the court will make you pay security for costs, so we've got security sitting in both cases that we've had to pay up front in case we lost. And we did win on one preliminary issue, and we're still waiting to see if we can get that back. And yeah, it's just, you just have to have faith. There's some great lawyers out there who will do the work for not much. The guy we've just had on the Crespo case, James Gardner Hopkins, has been amazing. Really, really clever barristers, and they recognise the importance of this issue and just want to give back, I think, and don't charge us through the nose, which is really helpful. So yeah, you've just got to have faith and give it a go and keep pushing. And, you know, we could give up on losing because the community has put so much money and effort, and they care so passionately. It just makes you want to take it to the end and keep going and make sure that there was nothing else you could do. So that's the position we're taking at the moment.
Yes, well, it's service to the common good, whereas in many cases we're fighting service to self. And so it's a big one for you. Now, can I ask, and I just want to say thank you anyway, that is wonderful of you, Nikki, being able to give you your time and really speak from your heart as the challenge that we've got, and it's huge. And I want to ask, have you been to a source of a gigantic or a large spring?
Oh, I have actually, and I can't even remember that. That's terrible, isn't it? Is it Blue Pools? Is it Poo Poo Springs?
Yeah, Poo Poo Springs, that's it.
That's the one, yeah. So, yeah, Poo Poo Springs, but like I said, and it was incredible. It was the most amazing colour, and the life under it that gave it the colour. But, yeah, that's the only natural spring I've actually visited myself. Like I said, it would have been nearly a couple of decades ago now. And it was incredible, and I don't know what it's like now, and whether it's been impacted by farming nearby and, you know, water extraction or the application of chemicals to the land. I don't know. I should get out more and check out some of natural water sources.
Yes, those pools. Well I went to, I think it was a Rainbow or Fairy Springs in Rotorua, and there was this area, it was about, I don't know, 7 or 8 metres wide, that's all. And all you could see was this pool of water, and there was something really, really clear. And then the pumice was floating through the water, so that you could see it coming up through the sand. And there must have been, I don't know, you know, 300 or 400 litres a second or something like that just coming out. It was just fantastic. It really, really shocked me, because we were surrounded by bush, and all of a sudden all you could see was this magnificence coming out of the water and then flowing away in a little creek. It was just something so spectacular.
Yeah, and we do need to get out more, because I think if we see it, we maybe start to appreciate how important and special it is. Water coming out of the tap, something we take for granted, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Well, when you're in nature a long way from anywhere and you come to a spring and you see it and the clarity of the water and you think, wow, where did this come from? Way down in the depths of Mother Earth, Papatūānuku, all of a sudden this water emerges and comes to the surface. And they say that any spring water that comes to the surface is fully mature water. This is Victor Schauberger, the father of water. And so this water is the best, and when you put water in a pipe and send it down a pipe 5 miles, 10 miles, or 20 miles, water loses its power. It loses its, I don't know what you call it, the mana. And we have to realize that getting water from the source is by far the best, and we in New Zealand need to make sure that we keep it that way.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Absolutely right.
Nikki, thank you for your giving and sharing.
Thanks for having me on. Yes, it's been nice to chat with you, Tom. Appreciate it.
And so I want to say all power to you, to the Aotearoa Water Action Group, and all people who at heart want a better world, a better New Zealand, healthier children, a more loving community. I just want to say thank you for adding and helping us bring this about. I trust you can go out today and know that you have really done a wonderful service for New Zealanders and the children of tomorrow.
Oh, wow, you're really overstating.
It's important. It's important.
Yeah, we just have to keep going. Keep on trucking.
That's the gal.
Yep, you take care.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Tim. Bye.
That was Nikki Gladding of Aotearoa WaterAction.org.nz. Aotearoa WaterAction.org.nz. Te Waikoro Pupu Springs, also known as Pupu Springs, are located in Golden Bay, New Zealand's South Island. The springs are known for the clarity of the water and the volume of water discharged. The springs are spiritually significant to Maori people. The spring feeds Te Waikoro Pupu River, a short tributary of the Takaka River. The water clarity is such that the horizontal visibility of the constantly 11.7 degrees cool water in the springs has been measured at an average of 63 meters, and until 2011 was considered second only to subglacial water in the Antarctic. Since that year, however, the record holder for fresh clarity of water is Blue Lake, also in that same district in the Northern South Island. And the volume of water is noticeable that is discharged is estimated at 14,000 litres of water are produced per second. This is quite profound. So if you are in the Takaka region up at Golden Bay, visit this place for a meaningful experience. Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send, and remember, even Facebook, to tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it, spread it, radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media and monopolies, but of 7.7 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Muller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 500 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. and become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch
and Lisa Eyre.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say Kia Kaha and Haere Uraha.